Hello everyone and welcome to the Iron Dice. This is Dan Arrows and you are about to listen to part 6 of our series on the early Weimar Republic. If you're new or don't remember what happened in the last episode, worry not, we'll catch you up to speed. Take care and enjoy.
We are determined that the vicious German cycle of war, phony peace, shall once and for all time come to an end.
This is London Court. Here is a news flash. The German radio has just announced that Hitler is dead.
Early this morning, the Soviet troops launched a general attack on Hungary.
Those who foolishly sought power by riding the back of the tiger ended up inside.
Tonight I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. None eyes have seen
the... Say that we are mired in stalemate seems the only realistic, if unsatisfactory, conclusion.
Over a million people here celebrating a day that they never thought would come. A day in which Germany became one country again.
Launched the opening salvo of Operation Iraqi Freedom.
If the Iron Dice must roll, may God help us.
The date is January 15th, 1919, and the hunt is on in Berlin. Heavily armed soldiers patrol the streets, stopping random citizens, demanding papers. They bust down doors and turn over every stone in their search for the leaders of the Spartacists. Merely 10 days ago, Berlin's revolutionaries grabbed their rifles and rose up against what they called a coup by the Social Democrats. In an attempt to secure the achievements of the revolution in November, a group of radicals had seized a number of buildings in Berlin's newspaper district. Armed fights broke out throughout the city, but shortly after, Freikorps units, volunteer units on behalf of the government, stomped out the uprising, and here's where we get back into our story. And now, it's not just the Freikorps units who are looking for Spartacists, but a number of citizen militias have formed. In the lead-up to this point in the story, people who had no affiliation to the military but became increasingly terrified of a communist takeover got together throughout the country to form these militias. Sometimes these were even paid directly by local business magnates or banks to protect property in case of revolution. In Berlin, the Freikorps and these citizen militias are determined to make sure the far left never rises up again. And while some of these groups might be claiming to, you know, act on behest of democracy or whatever, a lot of them really are just living out their desire to beat the crap out of everyone from communists to mild social democrats. As soon as the uprising got violently shut down, Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg, the two leading figures among the revolutionaries, knew that if they fall into the hands of the Freikorps units or the citizen militias, lifelong prison would be the best possible outcome. The, what one historian calls, boundless hatred these volunteer units have for these two is not to be underestimated. The government also has come out and said they're determined to put the leaders of the Spartacists on trial for their role in the uprising. At the same time, the city is still littered with leaflets calling for the straight-up killing of the two. It's a very dangerous time for them, without a doubt. That does not mean Rosa and Karl have been scared into silence, though. While they can't go out and hold speeches to the workers as they usually do, they still have their outlets through which they can reach their remaining supporters. We read a text by Rosa Luxemburg in the last episode that was published in the Red Flag, the communist newspaper, and Karl Liebknecht also releases a very powerful essay on the same day. It's called Despite It All. And this is interesting because, unlike Luxemburg, Liebknecht is not much of a political writer, but in this text, he just unloads all the anger and frustration he felt since 1914, when the German left began to fracture. The passage I'm going to quote to you is a bit long, but I think it's crucial to understand the sense of betrayal that he feels in part of the German left feels to this day even. On January 15th, 1919, Karl Liebknecht writes, "Spartacus crushed, they celebrate from Post to Vorwärts. Spartacus crushed, and the sabers, the revolvers and carabiners of the re-established old Germanic police and the disarmament of the revolutionary worker will seal its defeat. Spartacus crushed under the bayonets of Lieutenant Reinhardt, under the machine guns and cannons of General Lüttwitz. The election of the National Assembly is to be carried out, a plebiscite for Napoleon Ebert," referencing Friedrich Ebert here, the leader of the Social Democrats. "Indeed, they were defeated because they were abandoned by the sailors, the soldiers, the security forces, the army, on whose help they had relied, and their force was paralyzed by the indecisiveness and weakness of their leaders, and the monstrous counter-revolutionary mudslide of reactionaries and the propertied classes drowned them. Indeed, Berlin's revolutionary workers were defeated, and Ebert, Scheidemann, Noske have won. They have won because the generals, the bureaucracy, the robber barons and county squires, the clerics and the moneybags, and all who are narrow-minded, stunted and reactionary stand with them, and won for them with ammunition, gas bombs and mortars. But there are defeats which are victories, and victories more pernicious than defeats. But what about the victors of today? For a nefarious cause they perform their nefarious, blood-soaked work, for the powers of the past, for the mortal enemies of the proletariat. And even today they are inferior, for already today they are the hostages of those they sought to use as their tools and whose tools they have always been. Still, they give the firm its name, but only a short reprieve remains for them. Already they stand in the pillory of history. Never have there been such Judases as them in the world, who not only betrayed their holy of holies, but also nailed it to the cross with their own hands. Just as official German social democracy sank deeper than all others in August 1914, now, at the dawn of social revolution, it offers the most loathsome spectacle. Dragon's teeth sown, Spartacus crushed. Steady, we have not fled, we are not beaten, and even if they throw us in shackles, we are there and shall remain, and victory shall be ours. The road to Calvary of the German working class is not yet completed, but their day of redemption is near. The day of judgment for the Ebert Scheidemann Noske and for the capitalist rulers who still to this day hide behind them. The tide of events mount into the heavens. We are accustomed to being catapulted down from the peak into the depths, but our ship continues on its straight course, proudly sailing to its goal. And whether we will still be alive when it is reached, our program will live. It will rule the world of humanity redeemed, in spite of everything. Under the roar of the approaching economic crash, the still-sleeping hordes of proletarians will awaken as if summoned by the trumpets of the Last Judgment, and the corpses of the murdered fighters will rise and demand a reckoning from the damned. Today, still the subterranean rumbling of the volcano will erupt tomorrow and bury them all in glowing ash and lava flows." There is one part of this text that always stuck with me and is a little chilling reading it now. That is the sentence, "For already today they are the hostages of those they sought to use as their tools and whose tools they have always been." Think of Liebknecht what you want. I kind of like him, especially for his tenacity. That sentence is spot on. The Social Democrats using people who couldn't care less for democracy or republicanism to win the fight against the far left. That is them riding the tiger. And another thing from this text is true, that Karl and Rosa haven't fled. Despite being urged by their friends and allies, the two are still holding out in Berlin. Because Liebknecht really was someone who had a vision and felt a sense of historical responsibility. He had what people on the left today often lack, and that is belief. Not in a religious sense, but that what he was fighting for was inevitably gonna win out. Allegedly, when his father, Wilhelm Liebknecht, was on his deathbed, the last thing he told his son was, power to the workers. And ever since, that was Carl's credo, especially after World War I, because he was convinced that if there was no German Revolution, the Russian Revolution would dither away and capitalism would devour the world, as he put it. Preventing this was more important to him than anything else, more important than his wife, more important than his own children or even himself. So you can see why this guy doesn't just run away with his tail between his legs after the failed uprising. Same goes for Rosa. Sadly, the people looking for them know this too. They know he's not gonna cut and run. Despite It All is published on the morning of January 15th, and throughout the day, a rumor makes the rounds of where Liebknecht might be hiding. Some people suspect that the day his essay is published, he will be transferred from another hideout to an apartment in the Wilmersdorf district, which lies southwest of central Berlin. A group of locals in Wilmersdorf have formed one of these citizen militias and keeps an eye on a couple living there that is allegedly friends with Liebknecht. At roughly 9 p.m., the men of the citizen militia kick down the door of this couple, storm into the apartment, and find three people who fit the description of Karl Liebknecht, Rosa Luxemburg, and another leading communist figure named Wilhelm Pieck. The man they suspect to be Liebknecht insists that they're mistaking for someone else. He says his name is Markusson, who is the tenant of the apartment. As the militia guys pull out every drawer and search the apartment, they strip this guy down. As the militia guys pull out every drawer and search the apartment, they strip this guy down and notice that his shirt has some initials stitched on it. And these initials read KL. This seals the deal, and the citizen militia realizes they have made a big catch. They have caught the most vilified, most wanted people in the entire country. Karl is arrested on the spot. They drag him out of the building and throw him into a car, and where they're going to take him might be unexpected at first. Their destination is the Hotel Eden, one of Berlin's most luxurious hotels. Marble floors, chandeliers, servants to fulfill every request, and even a mini golf course on the roof. So Karl might have been a bit surprised when, instead of stopping in front of a gray prison block, the car stops in front of Hotel Eden. Upon entering, it dawns on Karl that this building, usually a place for the upper 10,000, now serves a much different purpose. Hotel Eden is crawling with Freikorps members. Since the Spartacus uprising, Hotel Eden has become the headquarters of the Garde Kavallerie Schützen Division. In our story, we have come in contact with these guys before, namely during the battle for Berlin Palace on Christmas Eve 3 weeks ago. These were the men who got humiliated by rebel sailors and afterwards were crucial in crushing the Spartacist uprising. Under shouts and insults, they push Liebknecht through the lobby and up the stairs. After a little while, they reach a private suite on an upper floor of the hotel. In this suite, Liebknecht is tied to a chair and gets to meet the man that now controls his fate. There is probably no greater gift in the world for this man than to be delivered the leader of the Spartacists, the demon of the revolution himself, who now sits in front of him, completely helpless. This man is the leader of the Garde Kavallerie Schützen Division and a fanatic anti-communist. It is General Staff Officer Waldemar Pabst, probably one of the most ruthless men in the entire country, even in a time during which ruthless men were not on short supply. And he shows his ruthlessness during his talk with Karl Liebknecht, who at this point still maintains that he is not who they are looking for. It's of no use, though. Officially, Pabst and his men want to question Liebknecht because there are still plenty of armed Spartacists in Berlin. It is not completely out of the question that they could even try to free him and Rosa. So Pabst wants to know where they are hiding out, where their weapons depots are, and so on. It ends up being much more of a torture session than a questioning, though. While Carl is tied down, they scream in his face, beat him repeatedly, spit on him. At one point, though, they put a pause on the torture, and Pabst picks up the phone from his heavy wooden desk. He only talks for a couple of minutes before hanging up again, turning around, and telling Carl that he is going to be taken to Moabit prison in central Berlin. So they untie him, again drag him through the hotel under an avalanche of verbal abuse by the soldiers present. And by now, the news has made the round, so there are even more people outside the hotel and pushing into the lobby. As Carl and his handlers reach the exit of the building, one of the soldiers pushes through the crowd and deals Liebknecht a massive blow to the head with his rifle butt. Carl immediately collapses onto the hotel floor with blood rushing from his head. He's still conscious though and tries to get back up somehow, and his handlers manage to get him outside and throw him onto the truck bed of a car waiting. Just as they're taking off, another guy jumps onto the truck and punches Liebknecht in the face, only to run back into the hotel lobby, showing his bloody fist to the cheering soldiers. The car, now officially on the way to Moabit prison, disappears into the night. At some point, though, the driver makes a turn where he shouldn't if his goal was Moabit prison. Instead, they stop at the Tiergarten, which is a big park right in the center of Berlin. They hold close to a lake in that park, and at this hour, the area is just pitch black. No light from streetlights, no restaurants, nothing. Next thing, one of the soldiers gets up, opens the back door, and tells Liebknecht, "All right, get out, be on your way." And it's like, huh? Are these guys Spartacists in disguise or something? Or was there someone higher up who called Pabst at the hotel and ordered them to release Liebknecht? Either way, Carl is able to get out of the truck, but before he's even able to turn around and run, his handlers raise their rifles and shoot him in the chest 3 times. The bullets burst out of his back, and Carl falls to the ground, dead. Shot while trying to escape, it will say in the official report. Meanwhile, Rosa Luxemburg is awaiting her interrogation in Waldemar Pabst's private suite. Reports from the time suggest she is pretty unfazed by all of this, or at least acts that way. While sitting in the suite, she mends the hem of her skirt, which had been ripped up on the way there. She also reads a bit of Goethe's Faust to pass the time. When Pabst shows up, the interrogation doesn't last very long. He merely asks, "Are you Rosa Luxemburg?" To which she responds with, "Decide for yourself." And with that, Pabst doesn't have any further questions and gives 2 men the order to escort her outside to the transport vehicle in front of the hotel. Her handlers lead her through the lobby, which is now crammed with people with the intention to harass and hurt her, shouting, "Kill her! Kill her!" Just no scruples whatsoever. In the lobby, they push her through the revolving door, and as she exits the building, one of the men nearby smashes her in the head with his rifle butt. Blood shooting from her nose and mouth, she collapses on the sidewalk. We don't know 100%, but it seems the blow to her head was so severe that she immediately loses consciousness. Instantly, a couple of men plunge at her lifeless body to pick up a trophy, so to say. They steal one of her shoes and a handbag. And as she is lying there, on the cold pavement, covered in blood, an unconscious, almost 50-year-old woman, the guy smashes her in the head with his rifle butt as hard as he can again. Only now it is that the soldiers who are supposed to escort her intervene, so to say, and drag her to the car. They put her in the middle of the back seat, one soldier to her left and one to her right. The car begins to slowly roll forward, but not too fast as to prevent an officer to jump onto one of the foot pegs of the car, draw his pistol, and shoot Rosa in the head. The car doesn't stop after that, and shortly after reaches a bridge over a canal close to Hotel Eden. The men get out, pull Rosa's body out of the car, and throw her over the bridge railing, down into the muddy water. Later that night, these guys would boast about what they had done to their colleagues, proudly proclaiming that the old bitch is already swimming. Lynched by the mob is the official statement given to the press afterwards. The third man who got arrested with Liebknecht and Luxemburg is set free, or escapes, depending on the account. Pabst will later say that the guy was willing to name a bunch of hideouts and weapon depots of the Spartacists, which might have saved his life that day. The exact details of how the decision was made to kill Karl and Rosa are very contentious, and the reason for that is who Pabst talked with on the phone while interrogating Liebknecht. That man, according to Pabst, was Gustav Noske of the Social Democrats, the man they sent to Kiel at the very beginning of the revolution, the man who deployed the Freikorps against the Spartacists. The content of this phone call is so explosive because in it lies the question, did the Social Democrats order the execution of Karl and Rosa, or did Pabst act on his own? Because what's clear is that Pabst made the decision to have them both killed and would even say so in later interviews. In his memoirs, Pabst claims that the murder was officially approved by the Social Democratic leadership, but his claims of how this approval was communicated are contradictory here and there. When it comes to the phone call between him and Noske, Pabst said that Noske wasn't willing to give him the official approval and told Pabst to ask his military superior. And when Pabst responded that he wasn't going to get this approval from his superior, Noske responded, "Then you have to decide for yourself what is to be done." Allegedly, I should say, Pabst might very well be lying about this. We probably won't ever know for certain. What we do know for certain is that, at the least, the Social Democrats, in their rhetoric and in their party newspaper foreword, contributed to the vilification that resulted in more than two cold-blooded murders. Much more. Not that the rhetoric in the Red Flag, the Communist Party newspaper, was in any way less violent or radical, but, you know, it wasn't the Social Democrats who got hunted down and executed by right-wing death squads here. And even if we can't know if Pabst acted on behalf of the Social Democrats, it's clear that a number of them were pretty happy about what happened to Karl and Rosa. On the night of the killing, Pabst passes on a description of the events to the press that is almost completely fabricated, by the way. Not even a full 24 hours later, Philipp Scheidemann speaks at a rally. He was the man who proclaimed the Republic from the window of the Reichstag and is second to Ebert among the Social Democratic leadership. Here's what he says at this rally about the just murdered Spartacist leadership. "Every day they had called the people to arms and demanded that they violently overthrow the government. They had traveled through Berlin with machine guns ready, which they set in front of the Reichstag many times. On a daily basis, they incited their followers to the boiling point. After streams of workers' and soldiers' blood was spilled because of them, they then accused us of being murderers and bloodhounds in their newspapers and at their rallies. Thus, they have fallen victim to their own bloody terror tactics. With Frau Luxemburg, a highly gifted Russian, I can understand the fanaticism. But not with Karl Liebknecht, the son of Wilhelm Liebknecht, a man who we all still respect and honor. His son, the deceased Karl Liebknecht, sadly got completely caught up with the Russian terrorist tactics." Scheidemann goes on for a little bit and then uses a metaphor to explain how Rosa and Karl had it coming, essentially, that is very telling. "If my mad brother aims his shotgun at me, if I am the only person he targets, I can allow him to shoot me in order to spare his blood. But when I am in the situation where I am rushing into a burning house to save my wife and children, and my crazy brother then attacks me, then that argument doesn't help anymore. Then I must use my weapon against him, because then it is not just about me, but about the lives of many others." Scheidemann is by far not the only one who sees the killings this way, and the opinions expressed in the press range from weak condemnations of the murders, but also kind of shrugging their shoulders in the liberal press, to openly celebrating on the right. Friedrich Ebert will never publicly address these events, although allegedly he was very shook hearing of the news and considered resigning. Freedom, the party newspaper of the Independents, is the lone public voice who calls Pabst's version of the events into question and demands an investigation. Not only do they publish eyewitness testimony that undercuts the official version, but also the fact that Karl Liebknecht's autopsy shows him being shot in the chest, not the back. How do you shoot someone in the chest while he's running away? They also put the blame at the feet of the newspaper Forward specifically and attribute the murder to the Ebert-Scheidemann politics of violence. In response, the government initially promises an investigation and to judge these crimes just as hard as the crimes of the Spartacists. That will never happen, though. And this is a great showcase of the moderates in the Weimar Republic somewhat digging their own graves here. Because the old military structures were left untouched after the revolution of 1918, the case of Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg will be left to a military court. In 1919, this court sentences two, basically fall guys, to minor prison time, but people like Pabst will never be brought to justice for this. In fact, Pabst will serve as an advisor to the court in this case, and even into the 1960s boasted about how he judged Rosa Luxemburg in interviews. This set a dangerous precedent of the government basically sanctioning violence against communists, and when we look at the entire system of government during the Weimar era, it goes much, much further than just the case of Rosa and Karl. Most officials in the court system after World War I had undergone a so-called monarchist patriotic education, and justices in particular often saw it as their foremost duty to fight communism rather than interpret the law. Let me show you two cases so you know what I mean. Case number one, in 1924, a barber in East Germany wanted to report an arms robbery committed by a couple of communists. Shortly after, four men jumped him in front of his apartment and shot him down. When this was brought before a court, three of the four men got the death penalty, with one being sentenced to 15 years in prison. Compare this to another high-profile case from the other side of the political spectrum. In 1920, there was a case surrounding a 19-year-old girl who worked as a maid in southern Germany. This girl went to the authorities to report an illegal weapons depot she found belonging to far-right extremists. A couple of days later, police found this 19-year-old girl strangled to death in a public park in Munich with a note on her chest calling her a traitor to the fatherland. This case did not even reach the inside of a courtroom. And this trend continues all throughout the Weimar era. Even someone like Friedrich Ebert, who will feel the sting of a fanatically right-wing judiciary in 1924, in a case that some historians suggest completely broke his spirit. An editor in a well-known newspaper had published an article that called Ebert a traitor to his country for his role in organizing strikes during the First World War. So Ebert tried to sue this editor for libel, and while he was successful in that, and the court fined this editor, they also wrote in the court's opinion that, legally speaking, Friedrich Ebert was a traitor to his country. So you can see the murderers of Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht getting off scot-free wasn't a fluke at all. It really was just the beginning of the end, in a way. While later on, there will be a vote in parliament that fails to re-examine the case against those guilty of the murders that Ebert votes in favor of, by that point it will be too late. In the immediate aftermath of the killings, the Social Democrats are way too preoccupied with defending themselves from any accusations of wrongdoing to exert any pressure, because they're thinking about the upcoming election. 4 days after Rosa and Karl meet their end, this new Germany holds its first federal election. And it's a big win for the Social Democratic Party, which receives the largest vote share with a bit under 38%. Coming in second is the Center Party, with roughly 20% representing the country's Catholics, especially in the South. The left-liberal German Democratic Party comes in at 18%, and the far-right nationalist German National Traditional People's Party gets 10%. And of course, there are a bunch of smaller parties getting some votes, but nothing of consequence there. Except that one of the losers of this election, arguably, are the independents, who come in at roughly 7%, which is not a great result. But following this election, there will be a big exodus from the Social Democrats to the independents, and they remain an important player among the left. The reasons for this exodus from the Social Democrats are numerous, but we can get a sense of why people might not want to be members of that party when we look at the 25th of January 1919. It's the day that Karl Liebknecht, along with those that died in the Spartacist uprising earlier this month, is supposed to be put to rest. For Rosa Luxemburg, they're going to carry an empty coffin since her body will not be found for months. The plan is to have a big funeral procession led by the families of those who died move through Berlin. What's important here is that this procession is not just made up of Liebknecht's and Luxemburg's most ardent followers, but all across Germany, people travel to Berlin for this. It's relatives, factory organizers, the unemployed, and even social democrats who knew Liebknecht and, despite their differences, wanted to pay respect to their old party colleague and friend. The Social Democratic government wants none of this. They're terrified that this funeral could spiral into something potentially destabilizing, and they enact a ban on all demonstrations and assemblies in central Berlin. They make an exception for the cemetery on which Liebknecht is supposed to be buried and some of the surrounding areas. Apart from this being a pretty bold move, banning a funeral procession, there's also hardly enough time for the information about this ban to circulate. Obviously, there is no social media in 1919, so this information has to be handed to the press. The press has to write it up and print it, then those newspapers need to be distributed. This stuff takes time. So when the day of the funeral procession comes, there is a ton of confusion around, coupled with military checkpoints throughout the city. The military, acting on behalf of the government, has put up machine gun nests, artillery, and large signs reading, "Anyone past this point will be shot." Despite that, those organizing the procession are mostly able to rearrange and control the flow of the massive amount of people. And this really might be the biggest funeral procession Berlin had ever seen for someone like Liebknecht, with over 100,000 attendees. For the most part, it's people who just want to pay their respect to Liebknecht, who, let's not forget, went to jail for his repeated organizing against the mass slaughter of the war. It is not a huge outpouring of the Spartacist masses, but rather people acknowledging the good that he did and what he stood for even before the revolution. But that fact makes the conduct of the government even worse, right? The independence newspaper Freedom, among other insults, levels the following question at the government in the wake of this. Are they afraid that the wounds of the victims will start to bleed again if they are carried through the Wilhelmstrasse? Or is it just the brutal instinct of power that belongs to the victor that drives them to also subject the working class of Berlin to this humiliation? If you are one of the people at this procession, the mourners, the grieving family members of those killed, and you are met with machine guns and artillery and soldiers threatening to kill you, how can you not ask the question, what was this revolution really for? What the government does here shows the fear that they have. The fear that even though they hold power right now, it might just slip from their hands if they are not extra careful. evidently they are willing to go to great lengths to demonstrate their authority. Because versions of what we have talked about in these last few episodes, the power struggle in Berlin, are happening all over the country. Berlin might be the center of power, but it's hard to establish government control over an entire country when the capital alone is that unstable. One of the cities that has been creating headaches for the government in Berlin is the port city of Bremen in northern Germany. And port cities during this time were, let's say, prone to revolution because of the two groups of people that emerged there. On the one half, you have the people making bank from the trade, the merchants. On the other half, you have the workers of the shipyards and factories who actually create the basis of wealth in the city. This leads to Bremen, among other cities, having a much more radical, more organized workforce than average. And this could even be seen during the war, when Karl Liebknecht got arrested in 1916 for organizing against the war. Workers in Bremen left their factories to strike, defying the government and the trade union leadership. In November of 1918, while the revolution spreads across the country, the workers and sailors in Bremen are quick to join the cause, and on November 14th, a leading figure of the local independence declares the dissolution of the city senate on the floor of the Bremen Stock Exchange. The council that from that point on runs things in Bremen is a broad leftist coalition made up of social democrats, independents, and communists. But when you read about this council, it almost seems like your leftist Twitter feed come to life. There is constant infighting and back and forth. The communists want to disarm and kick the social democrats out of the council. The independents, while supporting a revolution, don't want to do that. They want to maintain a united front against the right. Shortly after, the communists hold a big rally in the city, declare the socialist republic, and remove all social democrats from the councils and start to arm the workers. They also publish two telegrams, one demanding the government of Friedrich Ebert to resign, and another one proclaiming solidarity with Soviet Russia. Next thing they try is banning participation in the federal elections, on which they get outvoted by the independents sitting on the councils. And when the federal election takes place, the Social Democrats, after being kicked out of the councils in Bremen, receive a stunning 42% of the votes in the city. Coming in second are the left liberals, the DDP, with 33%, who weren't even part of the councils to begin with. And this shows the dilemma at the heart of all of this infighting and why people are still arguing over the German Revolution more than 100 years later. In Bremen, and Germany as a whole really, the radicals simply did not have the numbers. That is the cold, hard truth. If there ever was a revolutionary spirit in the country that could have carried on the world revolution, it simply wasn't there at this crucial juncture. The rule in Bremen, and the rule in Berlin even, if the January uprising had been successful, was, and would have been, the rule of a radical minority. After the federal election takes place, the situation for the city government changes from bad to worse when the banks say they won't give any further loans to them. Negotiations between the city government and the banks don't really lead anywhere, so that shortly after, the communists just simply occupy these banks for a brief moment. They also call for a strike in reaction to the banks denying further loans to the city, but the majority of the workers don't even show up for this. What truly signals the end of the Bremen Soviet Republic, as it's called, is the failure of the Spartacist uprising in Berlin. Because right after the revolution reaches Bremen in November, the other interest groups in the city, bankers, local industrialists, and so on, reaches out to the federal government and begs them to put an end to the revolution in Bremen. As you know, though, the government in Berlin is involved in their own struggle for power. But when the Spartacist uprising fails and the radical left is violently suppressed, it frees up units to be deployed somewhere else. And these units have been slowly amassing outside of Bremen, bringing their usual tools like machine guns and artillery, but also armored vehicles, which can be devastating in an urban environment. At the same time, Gustav Noske, the Social Democrat in charge of military affairs, sends a secret telegram to members of the Bremen upper class and right-wing circles, which simply reads, "Aunt Dora has passed away." That sentence is the code word signaling the imminent attack on the city. In addition to the government forces, 600 volunteers form a Freikorps unit, and these guys, for the most part, are not your typical World War I veterans like we've seen before. A lot of them are young people and the sons of Bremen business owners. On top of that, they are led by an officer who got his spurs clamping down on the Boxer Rebellion in China. The Bremen government is well aware that their days are numbered at this point, and they are willing to negotiate them handing over the reins of power. Too bad for them, though, because Gustav Noske, who is nicknamed the Bloodhound even before this, doesn't care about their will to negotiate. He doesn't just want to retake the city, but turn it into an example for anyone trying to defy the federal government. So before the negotiations even come to a close, he gives the order to march on Bremen. The few people defending the city are hopelessly outnumbered and outgunned, and also lack any kind of military experience. And these aren't soldiers, they are workers. To make matters worse, while government forces are already making their way into the city, the local government is fighting over the best way to defend the city. When they realize what is happening, wanting to prevent a slaughter, they publish leaflets telling their men to surrender and hand over their weapons. Not everyone adheres to this, though, and some revolutionaries even set those leaflets on fire in the city square. Noske's troops entering the city face some fierce but very uncoordinated resistance. After a couple of hours of intense fighting throughout the city, the bells are rung to welcome the government forces, and the red flag on the city hall is replaced by a red, white, and black one. The colors of the old Kaiserreich. The battle for Bremen leaves 83 people dead, 28 of those belong to the defenders of the city, 26 to government forces, and 29 civilians, including 3 children. What you might be wondering, hearing about this, is why the federal government is so willing to violently crack down on a city whose leadership was probably going to collapse anyway soon. The truth is that it's not just Bremen. After the January uprising in Berlin failed, workers in the big industrial hubs in Western and Central Germany rise up and demand the immediate socialization of large companies. Because while there might not be a majority in Germany for a quote-unquote world revolution, there is one to fundamentally alter the relationship between the workers and the means of production. When miners in the West call for a general strike, over 300,000 people join in. The amount of workers mobilizing, despite all odds at this point, is absolutely massive. In many places, these workers clash with Freikorps units, and the federal government is increasingly terrified of what this might turn into. It almost looks like the revolution that started in November, and that everyone considered to be over with the elections now, is about to enter a new, more radical phase. Even in Berlin, protests break out demanding more power for the workers, which is why the government sees itself forced to hold the National Assembly that is supposed to create a constitution and a proper government somewhere else, because the capital is simply too dangerous for them. And they decide on a city in southern Germany, mainly known for its association with the famous German writer Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. It is the city of Weimar. So even the very name Weimar Republic stems from the political instability rampant throughout the country. At this assembly, the Republic gets its first real government, stemming from the results of the election. Social Democrats, the Center Party, and the left liberal DDP form the so-called Weimar Coalition that is now supposed to create the basis for a new democratic Germany. They really can't do that, though, without dealing with all these internal pressures going on, though. The strikes, the effort of some regions to maybe split off from Germany proper, and maybe the biggest thorn in their side right now, the People's State of Bavaria that is about to become the Bavarian Soviet Republic. And the extreme amount of violence that we have seen so far in Berlin and now in Bremen is nothing compared to what is about to erupt in the south of the country. That is not all, though, because on top of all of this, the Weimar coalition is about to get immense pressure, not just from the inside, but from the outside. While Germany has signed an armistice with its enemies, there is no peace treaty yet. And this is what is about to hit the government and the German public like a freight train, when the Entente presents them, almost literally at gunpoint, the Treaty of Versailles.